Welcome to the SoGrow Marketing Council podcast. The SoGrow Marketing Council is a membership organization comprised of growing marketers who want to stay ahead of developments in multiple areas of marketing. This podcast features recordings of SoGrow Marketing Council meetings. Tune in to hear expert marketers share tips and discuss the latest strategies and tools in marketing. To join the next meeting and be part of the discussion yourself, visit SoGrowPR.com. That's SoGrowPR.com and click on the Marketing Council tab. Let's get growing.
The tip that I have today is one example that's highly demonstrative of this, which is hiring and the importance of marketing in hiring. When a business is hiring, it is very simple, of course, to talk about salary and our very cool office space and working hours and other logistical factors of this sort. But what the business is also doing is promoting its culture, whether they're doing so consciously or not. One of the ways in which they're doing that, of course, is through their marketing. So those candidates, even though they are not potential clients necessarily, will have an impression of the business based on the marketing that's happening, because marketing is all external facing in that way. So that is the public image of the business. So the two main problems I see businesses come across is when they either have not defined a company culture, so they're not able to get something concrete and consistent across in that marketing, or they have misdefined their company culture. So what they are presenting in their marketing as the company culture does not reflect the reality of working in that business. And when I talk about company culture, what I mean in short is the way that the employees interact with one another and the way that they interact with their work. And yes, that can be defined in very tangible and concrete terms. So with both of those errors, either where it's undefined or it is defined incorrectly, what happens is, A, you risk, of course, not attracting the candidates that would actually fit into that culture, so attracting the wrong candidates, and/or presenting a lie. So you get a great candidate and they start working in that business, and then it is nothing like what the public image of the business was. And so they feel lied to and betrayed, and it doesn't match their expectations. And anybody who has ever been involved in hiring knows that losing an employee, especially a new employee, is incredibly costly, not to mention highly disruptive to everybody who's also there. So it's something that any business wants to do everything they can to minimize that happening. So that's the importance of defining culture, which does have to come internally. That is an operational obligation. And then making sure that the marketing is reflecting that, that the story that is being told through marketing is the reality of who the business truly is, what they represent to the market, and the personality that that business has day in, day out in those working conditions. That's my tip for the day.
That's so great, Rebecca. And in terms of how do you make that communication happen between those two departments, do you have any suggestions in terms of how to make those conversations seamless?
For one thing, marketing, and no part of the business and marketing, so including marketing, should never start with a blank page, right? So it's not just about, okay, let's do something creative or just get a message out there that we know will resonate with an audience. It's about getting the message that is true and authentic to the business, a word that Lisa uses a lot, really important, getting that message out there. So it has to, that for marketing to be successful, and of course you're all in marketing, so you know this, you need the correct information from the business. So even when that's happening internally, where it's a marketing department, that marketing team needs to be getting the correct and reliable information from, let's say, the top levels of the business, who those decision makers, whether it's the owners or a board or a C-suite, to then make sure that the message, that the external image of the business reflects reality.
That's so true. Thoughts or questions for Rebecca? That's really helpful.
Rebecca, I want to ask you about how to make stuff, any tips on how to make stuff more authentic? And the reason why I'm asking, I came to Atlanta to work for an ad agency, and they talk about, it's a really big agency, and they talked about orchestrated marketing, and it never was true, and all the culture things they said were just propaganda, and everybody knew it, everybody laughed and snickered, you know, behind their backs. How do you make this stuff real when everybody's so cynical?
Yeah. So they're cynical for a reason, right? Because it hasn't been happening so far. So it's indicative of a mistake right there. And I want to point out the two levels of authenticity. There's the authenticity of the person and then the authenticity of the business. Where in a small business in particular, where the business owners are very present, these two things are very tightly related, but they are two different things. So again, I'm going to highlight Lisa, who is the expert on the authenticity of the person. When it comes to the authenticity of the business, it's looking at how all of those expectations and aspirations and hope of the business owners or decision makers reflect themselves in the day-to-day reality. So the key, and it requires a certain level of honesty, frankly. I mean, the situation you're describing requires a certain amount of dishonesty, I suppose. So it's, you know, looking at it that way rather than one would hope that the norm is that those business owners or decision makers do want to reflect reality and honesty. But it can take some digging because very often when we describe ourselves or our businesses, what we are describing is what we wish it were or hope it would be rather than what it is in reality. So that's where it can take some extra digging and some extra work. One way I like to do that is looking at concrete examples. So when somebody says, well, our business is this or works in this way or represents these values, I will ask for 5 specific examples, something observable and tangible that prove that point. Sometimes what we find is those values are not the ones being reflected, but it doesn't matter because the reality is a different value, which is just as good. It's just a question of getting the right definition.
Right. Absolutely. That's so true. It's just the authenticity is huge because what's the point of marketing if it's not true? Right. So that leads us into Lisa. So Lisa, would you like to introduce yourself and share your tip today?
Sure. Lisa McGuire, fractional CMO and personal brand and messaging strategist. And Rebecca, you teed this up so well for me. And thank you, Joel, for asking that question. So first of all, I want to talk about when you hear the term personal branding, I hear a lot of people cringe or they back away. But I'd like to reposition that a little bit today. Think about, you know, it doesn't mean you're an influencer. It doesn't mean that you have to tell every little detail about yourself, but we all have a personal brand, whether we know it or not. So let's reframe that and think of it as your reputation or your image, what people think about you or say about you when you're not in the room. So that does lead us to that word authenticity. And when we hear authenticity, again, people don't know what that is. I mean, Joel, you just demonstrated that so well, is what you say, who you really are. And I'll give the example. I've met several people on LinkedIn through their comments and posts, and we agree to have a virtual meeting. And when I get on Zoom with them, they are not anything like they show up in their post. And I'm thinking, who are you? Where did you come from? Where is my friend I made on LinkedIn? They're very, very different. So when you think of authenticity, there's also the word transparency. And I heard this a few weeks ago, and I thought this was an amazing way to describe it. Authentic is being who you really are. And as Rebecca said, it comes by evidence. It comes by examples. It comes by things that we can really measure and point to. But it doesn't mean that you have to show every little detail of your life. There is a level of transparency. And we as marketers, you know, if you think about graphics, you can adjust the transparency of an image, right? How dense it appears or how filtered it is. We do want to choose what we're sharing with people. And so when you are expressing yourself as your personal brand, it's very important that you present yourself truthfully. So where does the evidence come from? And this is my tip, is you are going to show up much more magnetic and more confident if you have the evidence to know who you are. That is done by making sure that you understand how you are wired. You also have to understand how other people see you. And we don't know that. We have to ask other people, what is the image? What do people think about you? What do they think your skills and your talents and tricks are that you have that make you magical? And what are the evidence pieces that you have throughout your life that are clues that brought you to where you are today? And then finally, what are the stories you're telling yourself that if you were to tell someone else, they'd say, why do you think that about yourself? Because that filters how we show up. So once you have that confidence, you know who you truly are, the second piece is being sensitive to your audience. You have to be empathetic and know where your audience is coming from. It's that client-centric messaging, right? You have to know what they're thinking, where they're coming from, and what they need to hear from you. So personal brand communications are done not for you, but they're done in the service of others to help people know, are you the person they want to work with, or are you the person they want to work for? And that's my tip.
That's so great, Lisa. So do you have any tips for people who are private and don't necessarily want to put a lot of things out there? Because it seems like the people that are really successful are the ones that just put everything out there. And they're just so honest and so raw about things. It seems like there's a trend in the marketing world to just put everything out there. But that's not necessarily everybody's personality. Right. So where do you feel like, how do you feel like people determine that line as far as like sharing too much versus not sharing enough so people don't know you well enough?
Right. That's a great question. And what I always look at is, okay, if you are more reserved and you don't want to share much about yourself, what is a lesson that you have learned in your life that you could then tell a story about, right? So you're doing it in the service of others. What is the one controlling idea, the one lesson you want people to learn? And then just tell a little short story. It could be 3 or 4 lines and then lead into the content. But that's a way to dip your toe in the water. And when you find out that you're not going to lose all your friends and you're not going to lose all your business, you can get a little bit deeper into that.
Right. That's helpful. Does anybody else have questions for Lisa on personal branding and authenticity? And
I think one thing that it made me think about is I do a lot of our social media and I'm really immersed in everything going on with the new AI tools and all the different things that we can do with that. And I mean, everyone's brain is exploding just on every level of business of how we can use AI and all the things it can do. What I do think, we are not going to have any lack of information. It's going to be able to spit out so much information with the volume, and it's going to get the accuracy right at some point. But the story and the human connection and the authenticity and the humor and the cleverness, those are things that cannot be. And I think that's going to become so much more important. And I just love both your statement about the authenticity and Rebecca's statement about companies. If you're not being real and you're just spitting out information and data points, people can get that anywhere. People, and if anything, it's just going to be noise. So like the real stories that are going to come through are going to be, the ones that are real. So anyway.
Right. And that's even more of a challenge in the business to business world. It makes perfect sense in the consumer world when you're putting all this personal stuff out there. But in the business to business world, you still have to build that authenticity. But it's a bit of a different setting. So that's great. Thank you for sharing, Lisa. I appreciate it. I love to hear about personal branding. I feel like even that touches us as marketers for our clients, but also for ourselves as well. So it's a very important topic for us.
Absolutely.
Oh, wonderful. Joel, would you like to introduce yourself and present your tip today?
Good morning, guys. Joel Alpert from Market Power. I want to talk this morning about thinking strategically. And I want to make a case that it's more than strategic planning that should be done once a year in a retreat, that it really should be a function of everyday thinking. Why am I saying that? Because I don't do strategy per se every single day. I do branding and copywriting and targeted marketing, email presentations, whatever it is, day to day. But I'm suggesting that all these things could have a strategic bent to them. And rather than get definitional and weird with academic tap dancing, I want to suggest a very practical, real example, just real life. Give me directions. How do I get from where I am to Cumberland Mall, right? That's a strategic plan. I'm here. I want to get there. What would you think about? You think about the end goal, where I want to go. You think about your starting point, where I am right now. You think about the turns along the way, the landmarks, maybe how many miles, how many minutes, whatever. There's specific metrics that you might think of along the way. You might think about whether or not you want to do a scenic route or the fastest route on the highway. So you would add those criteria and you would pick what's relevant and what's not relevant. including things that are not relevant, you may surface them, but then you throw them out. You would say, I'm going to pass a lot of Camrys along the way. I'm going to pass a lot of Ford F-150s. True, but it's not relevant to getting where you want to go. So you want to just focus on what you need to focus on. When we think strategically, our vision or goal takes the highest priority, and everything else, the process, serves that vision. So the process doesn't have to be celebrated, because you can plug in any process that works. I don't care whether I go on an I-85 north to 285 west, whether I go 85 south to 75 north. If I'm going to Cumberland Mall, I can get there from my area of town either way. Now, both get me there around the same amount of time. So the process is not to be celebrated. It's the end result that needs to be focused on. We don't tend to focus a lot when we do stuff these days. We are so unfocused that we don't even talk in words anymore. OMG, OLL, emojis, right? We're not even thinking. We're just wording, you know, just whatever we're doing. So I'm making a case for trying to be clear about when we are trying to get somewhere, to really try to focus on where we want to go. I want to make a distinction also between, we don't want to think capriciously, because if we just do anything, it's not really a plan. And a plan has to have action. So, but there's a difference between the plan and the action. The plan is more of a strategic bent, a leadership role, and the action is more of a management role, a day-to-day kind of thing. They're really different skills, and they can be done by the same people, but often they're very different. So there was a study in the Harvard Business Review recently that said that 23% of leaders were really good at leadership and at strategic thinking. They're good at managing, but they're not so good at thinking strategically. So when we're thinking about the end result stuff, strategically, we're way ahead of the game. I just want to give you three quick examples of where this might play out. If you're doing big picture planning and you want to have the pieces of the puzzle working together, if you've got a software company and you sell a product, but you really make your money from the back end service, well, you might want to think about, if you're really working together, you might make it easier to buy the products. You make more money on the back end, right? So it's just like a simple example. If you are fine tuning your products and services, you want to keep your end result in mind, your users. The smallest client that I worked for last year, smallest, was a shoemaker, a master craftsman in my neighborhood. And there's also in my neighborhood is an office park full of lawyers. So what I said to him, like, why don't we put out some flyers at the law firms and say we have pickup and delivery? Well, guess what? Those lawyers were sending him four pairs of shoes at a time at $150 per repair. Not bad. He would get a couple a week. That really helped his business. So your product and service offering might even be fine-tuned for your market or who you're trying to serve. Last example is, you don't want to think in silos. So basically, you know how, like, when you get like Xfinity, it tells you, rate our service, would you use this again? What they really want, you know, well, are you satisfied? What they really want to know is, do we have a steady stream of business that we can report our next quarter earnings? They don't really care about what you think and whether your service has a problem with it. But what if some of those people got some back-end opportunity to fix any kind of problem you might have? You would keep more people with that and reduce churn by doing that properly than just by doing some amorphous, ridiculous survey that doesn't mean anything. So across sales, marketing, operations, service delivery, everything that you do, if you have your current goal in mind and you think strategically, you're really able to perform much more effectively in all functions of your business.
That's great, Joel. I appreciate you bringing this to the marketing strategy level, which is one reason why we wanted you to come, because marketing strategy touches all of us as marketers. So thoughts, questions for Joel. What do you guys think?
Thank you for that, for defining those different elements, which is, so we all use that terminology. It's so helpful to have those categories. What do you find that clients most misunderstand about those differences between strategy, plan, tactics, and the business versus marketing level?
Well, one thing, the bigger the company you work for, the worse this is. But even in small companies, people hate this stuff. They don't want to do it. So they don't even, they're not even, you know, they go, give me a break. I could be catching up on my work today and not doing your stupid retreat, right? They hate it with a passion. So unless it has real value to them, you got to get that straight to begin with. And then you need to have a drill down plan so that it's not just a what I call three ring binder babble. So it's like when you have just an idiot plan on paper, it doesn't do anything in the real world. You have a plan on paper. You need to define and distinguish how you lay that out. So when you have a plan that's transferable, you can do a good job with it. You can actually enact it. So the biggest disconnect, I think, happens when the plan doesn't really work for folks and it doesn't really enact very well.
So, Jill, do you have any suggestions in terms of planning your strategy and deciding what is that end result that you want? So let's say you can pick Cumberland Mall. For those of us that are here, that's a local thing. Or maybe you're like, I want to go to the Statue of Liberty thousands or hundreds of miles away. So how do you determine that end goal within realistic parameters?
I'm not sure how to, I know I wouldn't go 85 south if I was going to the Statue of Liberty, that I know.
No, but I just mean in terms of like having a goal that's so far out there that it's unrealistic. How do you make sure that where you're going and the end result that you are trying to get to is something that's attainable and you're not just setting a goal that's so far out there that even though you can maybe see a road to it, it's just so far out there that it's unrealistic.
So one thing, Stephanie, I don't like 5-year plans. I don't like 3-year plans. I think that's stupid. I'm sorry for my candid assessments, but I think they're really just like uninformed. They're ridiculous. So don't do long-term plans. Don't do things that are completely unattainable, but do things that are worth putting your life spirit into. So if you have some weak plan that you don't even want to do as a company, as a leader of the company, as people, as managers and directors of the company, and you don't really care that much about it, what kind of motivation do you really have to do it? You know, but if you really love it and you really want to do it and you want to, you have motivation, you care. So one thing I try to make it bite-size and doable and a little bit of a stretch goal and all that, but you always have to figure out in the process what the motivation of the end user is, who you're marketing to, and what the motivation is of the people who are doing the work. If you can get, I love the word motivation. I learned that from my mentor, Robert Fritz. He talks about what really drives the person. What do they really care about? What are they really motivated about? Not just like, what does the customer want? You can give them like a very fast answer to that. It's academic, but what really drives them? Like what's the thing that really makes them want to do it? It's a one level deeper. You know, so it's almost like the authenticity that Lisa was mentioning before. It's like what's really inside the person that really wants to do it. When you connect all those dots, your plan is energized. So
that's great. I'm seeing a theme through all of the tips today: authenticity. So before we move on to marketing strategy, any other thoughts, questions for Joel? All right, Yana Tori, would you like to introduce yourself and share your tip?
Definitely. So, hi, everyone. I'm Yana Tori. I'm a deliverability specialist and co-owner of 2 email-related businesses. I am not the person that sends out the emails. I just make sure people get them. So it's on the technical weird part that no one ever thinks about unless there's a problem. So last month, we talked about how Google and Yahoo had announced in October that they were going to be a little bit more strict. And for the ones who don't know, nothing has really changed. They're just enforcing things that they've been saying for years, and they've made a public announcement, so now everybody has to adhere. Since last month, I've been getting a lot of calls. People are panicking. They think it's the end of the world. Email marketing is not going to work anymore, and that's not the case. But there are a couple of things that we need to set straight. So one of the things people are scared about is emails not landing in the inbox anymore. So emails are landing in promotions tab for years, and people always panic when that happens, and they think that's spam. It's not the same thing as a spam box. So spam box is emails that we don't want you to see, or Google or Gmail or whatever doesn't want you to see. When it goes to promotions, it's what that particular subscriber wants. So if I'm, you know, signing up to Target or Best Buy, I do personally want those emails to go in the promotions tab, and I want my inbox to stay clean so that I can answer back, you know, to Stephanie and Sarah and all of you guys. And when I feel like I'm going to go buy something or I have nothing better to do, I will go look at the promotions tab and I'm in the right mindset. So it helps convert better. So now that we got that out of the way, and also people don't all use it. Some people just use their inbox chronologically. It depends whatever you want. And Google is going to maybe share, like, so for example, I tend to reply back to the emails from SoGrow PR. So Google has realized I do that and has taken them out from the promotions or the updates tab and has put it in the inbox. So I may get in the inbox now and some of you guys may get in the promotions tab. So it is very important to not panic about it and not try to change the wording and make it convoluted so people don't really know what to do anymore with the email just to get into the inbox. It might have a negative effect, actually. Most studies that have been done is quite a high negative effect because that's not where they want the email. So they get a little bit annoyed, so they're more likely to unsubscribe. Today, I wanted to talk about the different tools that people use online. So there are a couple tools that everyone loves to use and it makes them feel better that everything is okay, even though it definitely isn't. So I'm going to share my screen here so that everybody can see. So one of the things that we have is the sender score. People are going to put an IP or a domain in here and they're like, 100%, I'm great. Close the laptop, let's send some more emails. So I wanted to explain how this works. So this website is owned by Validity. And one of the features or products that they offer is a feedback loop. A feedback loop, very easily put, is just a system that is able to process spam complaints. So instead of you connecting directly to Yahoo, connecting to Microsoft and so on, you can just connect to them and they will process all the spam complaints from the inboxes that provide that information. Google and G Suite is one of the companies that does not provide it. So if you're using Gmail and you report an email as spam, there is no communication side going to MailChimp or HubSpot or anything like that. What you see here is the information they get from that kind of reporting. So if, for example, you were sending a lot of emails that people were reporting them as spam using Microsoft, they're going to know that. If, for example, you're on a block list that is public information, they're going to know that. What they don't know specifically is if Gmail, Yahoo, and all these people are actually going to accept your email. They just see based on the spam reports and data like that, they have no idea if Google likes you or not. So you may have an 100% sender score here, everything is great, but it doesn't mean their emails are landing in the inbox. And you can see the reverse, where they might have seen some information because maybe you bought a domain and previously it was, you know, used for abuse, and that's the information they have. But at the end of the day, it's a new owner, new company, new things being done, no more scamming. Therefore, Google, Microsoft, and so on is going to accept the emails. The IP I put here was an IP from MailChimp, which is why there's that much data. And of course, they take care of their infrastructure. The second one that people like to use is a mail tester. Mail tester is great if you want to check if your emails are still authenticated properly. So this is from my inbox. But as you can see here, I sent this email. It's a blank email from my inbox. The IP that was used from Gmail was on a block list. My email is still going to land in the inbox. I sent it, you know what I mean? So it's very important to take this with a grain of salt. The only information they have here is like public information. And the best parallel I'm going to do is, you know, when you go to the bank or the bank website and you try to see if you can get a loan. So you put all your information in and at the end it says, yeah, great, you can get a loan. That doesn't necessarily mean that if I go to the bank, they're going to approve the loan. So they have as much information as they can, you know, salary and so on. But once I get to the bank and the real process happens, the answer can be totally different. And that's what's happening here. So if you guys want to know what is happening, so I changed the domain and you want your real reputation, the best way to do it is by using Postmaster tools. It's free. It's from Google. And usually people's lists are about 80, 90% Google or G Suite accounts. So it's very important to do this when you start sending emails. It only appears, of course, the data, if you're sending a couple hundred emails a month, you need to be sending emails. If you're not sending emails, there's no data to give or no reputation to give. They want to be able to see what's coming in, see what people are doing before they tell you. And because Google doesn't report or doesn't give back anybody who's complained, it is extremely important to understand and see this data. So for example, with this customer, you see the spam rates are through the roof. And because the information is not relayed, that means that the MailChimp, the HubSpot, whatever tool they're using is not removing these people from the list. So this is compound. 10% today of that day, October 29th, people clicked manually on the report a spam button. And then the next day of another, let's say, what is it, 2.9%. That's compounding. So over time, these people should have been removed and they can't be removed. So in a couple of months, if you don't know this and you don't do anything, try to figure out who may not be engaging with emails anymore. Google is going to start putting the emails in spam. That's where your reputation gets hurt. They gave you a reputation here as well. So that's one of the other options that they offer. Very easy, high, medium, low, or bad. A lot of companies tend to be in the medium. And I will explain to you why you should be a little bit stressed about making it in the medium. So if it's high, if you have a high reputation, it's a promise of about 90% or more is landing in the inbox. They can't always allow everybody to get emails because, as you can imagine, for a good example, I don't live in Canada or the US anymore. So I still keep getting like emails from Target and Walmart. I unfortunately cannot shop there. So slowly Google starts realizing I may not care because I'm too lazy to unsubscribe and I have too many inboxes to clean. I don't have time for that. So slowly some of those emails are going to go to spam, or they're going to disappear from my inbox, or the cadence is going to disappear. That doesn't mean Walmart is a bad sender. It just particularly I should be removed from the list. That's why it's 90% and over. Low means that 90% or more are landing in the spam box. Bad is everything's going to spam and also nowhere. Medium, though, is between 10 to 90% of the emails that are landing in the inbox, which means you don't know if you're closer to 90 or you're closer to 10%. So it's extremely important to take that medium and make it high. And the best thing you can do is clean your list. I'm going to say it every call. The best thing you can do to make sure people keep getting your emails is removing the ones that are just useless. We all get too many emails. We can't possibly, even if we're paying for newsletters, we can't possibly read those daily trading newsletters, for example. So I'm paying to get my emails, but on the Google side or the spam filter side, all they see is that this crazy person is sending 365 emails a year, and Yannatori is reading 10, 20. That ratio is horrible. So hence the panicking last month when the announcement was made. If you want to know something that's a little bit more precise than Sender School or Mail Tester, one of the things you can do is an inbox placement test. So the way that inbox placement tests work is that the system will give you a list of email addresses. You send a campaign or from your inbox directly to that list that has been provided. And that list is like the email addresses and inboxes are owned by the company. So what they do is that they let you know where the emails have landed. Now, it's important to understand as well that this is also not as precise as, you know, Google Postmaster, which is like a credit score from Equifax, instead of just, you know, calculating your salary and how much money you have saved up and how many bills you skipped the last couple of months. What they're going to do is, because these inboxes have no humans, no one's opening, clicking or anything, they are neutral inboxes. They're inboxes with no personality, like that example I said where, you know, I particularly like to reply back to the SoGro emails because they respond back. So therefore, they go to inbox. Kind of the same thing here. And you can do with the different providers that are on your list, of course. If you want to test, like we have French providers. If you're not sending to France, it might say it's going to spam just because they don't know you. When you see this information, it is time. First thing you do, you clean your list. And the second thing you need to do is to double check that if somebody using your identity to be sending out emails and your business, the smaller your business or the less important you think your business is on the grand scheme of domains, the more chances are that somebody is using your domain to send out because you have great reputation. You don't ruin your reputation. You don't send out enough emails for Gmail and so on to maybe even care about what you're doing so far. So it's extremely important to be doing these kind of tests over and over throughout the year, just to make sure everything is fine. And the information provided is very cool. This was a test from one of my friends. She was using MailChimp at the time. Everything was fine. The IPs on MailChimp were not on a block list. Same thing with the domain. And it's important to understand that if MailChimp is on a block list, they will take care of it. So you don't have to worry about that. Worry about your own domain. And these tests also tell you right now or at that moment of the test if your domain was authenticated, yes or no. And at the time, she didn't have DMARC. So it is important to do this a couple of times a year because sometimes you may blame your strategy, your marketing, the subject line, and that wasn't the case. The problem was no one got the email. So it's extremely important to make sure that you're not only looking at publicly available information and get it directly from the source. And because you're sending emails to lists, if Google's happy, in terms of like ratios and percentages, most likely so are all the other companies like Microsoft and so on. Only three companies offer this kind of information: Google, Microsoft, and the Verizon family, so Yahoo, AOL. And or else you're going to have to be doing inbox placement tests to check what's happening with iCloud. And I will stop there because I can keep going.
That's so great. So I have a question, and this is not my area of expertise. So let me know if this question does not make sense. But what about, this seems a lot like consumer emails, like personal emails. How does this work in the business-to-business world when emails are not through Gmail or Yahoo and that sort
of thing? Oh, it's the same. So your reputation comes from your domain. So if you were to move from like G Suite to like Hotmail, Microsoft Office, that reputation will follow you. Now, the receiving machines are going to find it a little bit weird, kind of the same idea of like, you know, using your credit card in a new country. So there's a little bit of a couple of things you need to be doing to make sure everything's okay. But the reputation comes from your domain. So even if you're using your inbox or like in the US, you guys are legally kind of allowed to do cold email. New York and California is coming in the way of that. And I don't know why people don't understand that at the end of the day, you don't know where your customers are. You have an email address. It doesn't mean that you don't have to be compliant with CAN, spam, CASL, GDPR, and so on. But the US is coming for you anyways. And Google and Yahoo decided we don't want you to be sending cold emails. So you may not be sending that many emails, but if they figure out that you are doing cold emailing, they're going to just brand your domain and they're going to know that's what you're doing. And you guys need to make sure that that doesn't happen. So it's very important as much as possible, if possible, to not do the cold emailing at all. It's a dying industry. At the end of the day, the only people who are going to be able to do it are people who are going to be focusing like by hand and doing it. You won't be able to use tools anymore and so on. And rotating domains doesn't help, unfortunately. They know it's you. They definitely know it's you. It's not because you go to a new bank that your credit is better.
Right, right. So thoughts and questions for Yana Tori. Email marketing is something that we all have to deal with as marketers.
I got a quick one. I don't know if it's a quick one. I hope it is. I just did a fundraising email. Okay. And I asked donors to share the pitch with 8 other people that might also contribute to this cause.
Yeah.
I was told by a fellow marketer that AI is going to scan that and might stop it. Is that true? To what extent? Or should I go smack my buddy? Is it true?
Okay, so it's half of a myth. So content it's not because you have the word sale in your email that is going to spam, kind of thing. Okay, so it's not because you're asking people to do, that's not the reason the emails are going to spam. On a different side, and I give this example all the time, during COVID, at the beginning of COVID, that June where everything just shut off, the high-end brands decided they were going to tell everybody, you know, like, I hope everything's okay. And then you're getting like an email from Louis Vuitton, like, I don't care. This is not your branding, right? It's not the tone of voice. It's not what we're expecting. The spam filters put that in spam for a very long time because it was bye, 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 bye. And then it was like, oh, I hope you're okay. And that was just too weird. So in that sense, the content can affect, but that's based on the perception that these machines have of you and what you're doing. So if you're just asking people to share, which is really good, actually, having somebody reply back or forward the email to somebody else, it looks amazing on you. It looks really, really good, unless the reply is all in caps and says, stop emailing me, which they can read. It's really good that people are forwarding and sharing your emails. The content is more as if you've never sent an email before, and maybe it's going to go to spam, or people are not expecting that from you, so they might get annoyed, or the way they're going to do stuff in their inbox, they open and they close it really quickly, or they delete it, you know. But on its own, that's not the reason the emails will go to spam. So you don't have to worry about that.
I am definitely going to forward this video.
Please, you all of you forward this video to 8 of your friends.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, Tori. So if someone, like, if that email gets forwarded and someone gets it and they didn't want it and it's not like a friend and they're like, oh, why did he send
it? Not on you. It doesn't reflect on you.
And they mark it as, what if they mark it as spam? Does that go back and hurt Joel?
No, it goes back to the last person who sent that email out.
Okay.
So, it. Yeah. So then
that's good.
You can report Gmail as spam if you want.
Good question.
But, yeah, no, it's a reputation thing. So it's really the identity, and which is why the authentication part was so important. because now they can really, really make sure that these emails are coming from you and these emails from MailChimp are not yours, actually. They can make that difference a lot better now.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main takeaways, be good on email and don't be spammy and make sure you're authenticated and clean your list, right?
Yes, always clean your list.
Your list.
We'll talk about that next month, how to do it.
It's not as painful as you might think, because if people are not opening your emails, what good does it have? What good does it have?
Yeah, what's the point?
Yeah, just take them off. It's okay. Nope. Awesome. Thank you so much, Yantori. I appreciate it. All right. Make sure everybody puts your name and contact information in the chat. I'm going to share a quick tip to wrap us up today. My name is Stephanie Richards. My company is SoGrow Public Relations, and we do business-to-business public relations. And today, I want to talk about something that I keep seeing with something called a boilerplate. Some of you may have heard of this term boilerplate. Some of you may not be familiar with it. But a boilerplate is something very common in public relations, and it's the paragraph that is included at the end of a news release. And it will say about the company, or it'll say about us, and it'll have 3 to 5 sentences about the company, and it's a standard practice on news releases. What I'm finding is that a lot of people will come to us and they will say, please write us a news release, and I'll say, thank you, send us your logo, send us this information, and send us your boilerplate. So many of the companies say, I don't have a boilerplate. And it's for more than just a news release. And that's why I want to talk about it today. A boilerplate is important for any company, whether you are sending out news releases or not. You can think of a boilerplate as your official short company bio. And the reason that this is important is because it helps you to describe your company in one short paragraph. And then you take that paragraph and you use it in all of the places that you are posting short bio about your company, and it's consistent across the board. And that's what's so helpful about it. So we'll write a boilerplate for a company. We'll put it on the bottom of a news release. If you have something like LinkedIn page where you've got the profile of the company, that's a great place to put it there. If you are doing like trade shows and you've got a profile of your company online, you're going to want to pop your boilerplate in there. If you're doing speaker proposals, they'll often ask you for a description of your company. It's the same thing with award submissions as well. If you have online directories, if you're doing an event and you have a description that you need to put in there, advertising, there's so many places where you can use this information, and it's helpful to have it consistent across the board. It's even great to have this on your website as just an introductory paragraph on your website. And if you're doing media relations and an editor is asking for a short description of your company, you copy and paste that. If employees get this question and they need a short description of your company, you copy and paste it. And it's just helpful to keep that consistent messaging all across the board. So I would just say, make sure that your company has a boilerplate. Make sure you keep it up to date. It's good to update it, look at it a couple times a year. If you have new information, add that information in there. And then make sure your clients have boilerplates as well. And just to give you a little description, that boilerplate will have your company name. A lot of times it'll include the location. And then you'll have some sort of sentence. And Rebecca, this is really where you come in about having that one sentence, that core message that really says what your business does. You may throw something else in there. Maybe you guys have, you're an award-winning firm or, something else that's noteworthy. And then you'll have some sort of contact information, whether it's for more information, visit our website. Some people do their social media accounts, or if they have a book, something like that would be good to put in there. And this even happens a lot of times if you are, let's say, an article author. A lot of times that boilerplate will be at the end of your article. So you want to have some sort of link back to your website, because sometimes that's the only link that ever gets back to your website is the one that's in your author bio or your boilerplate. So those are something that I keep having companies say, write us a news release. They have no boilerplate. And so I have to write them a boilerplate. And it's just something that they're not thinking about and they're not using. And so everything that they're posting is not necessarily consistent across the board. So how many of you have an official boilerplate? Who's even heard of a boilerplate before? I'm curious if this is new or if you guys are like, yeah, I've got my boilerplate. No boilerplates?
I don't have I know what it is. I don't have one. What is I'm a solo practice. I run my practice on my own. but a boilerplate still applies, I guess is my question, even for a solopreneur, an individual.
Right. Absolutely. And a lot of times you can use a boilerplate in an author bio similarly, because you'll say, you know, Rebecca Brizzi, managing consultant of RG Brizzi. And then, you know, a lot of the information is going to be the same if you are a solopreneur, but it's basically just having that short paragraph that you can just copy and paste and use in all these places to have consistent messaging. So are you guys all going to go get a boilerplate today? This is your homework from today's meeting. Other homework from today's meeting is sign up for the March 20th Sober Marketing Council. Sarah, can you put a couple of these links into the chat? So go ahead and sign up an RSVP to reserve your spot. And if you would like to submit a tip and present next time, you can go to the Sober Marketing Council website. And there's a section under the menu bar that says submit, and you can submit your tips. And we'll let you know if your tip is approved, and then you'll be invited to present your tip. And tips are educational and informational. And like I said, they end up on the recordings that we do for LinkedIn Live, on our YouTube channel, and our podcast. And also, please go to our YouTube channel and subscribe. We really need subscribers, and our podcast, subscribe as well. And then, you know, as we talked about with the email and forwarding things, we really would love to grow the Sober Marketing Council. And we would like to start an Atlanta group soon that meets in person. And so we would love for you guys to invite your friends and anybody that you know in marketing that's executive level, that's really good at just educating people and sharing tips. We would love to have them join, especially we're looking for like SEO. Sarah, what are some other areas that we are looking for? We love sales. That's another area. There's just
event marketing.
We haven't had any events in a while.
Digital marketing, any kind of digital is always welcome. We're open. I mean, just pretty much there's a long list, but yeah.
All your marketing friends. So, and again, we'll broadcast on LinkedIn Live because we would like to set you guys up as experts. We want you guys to get exposure. And so you guys can take your video tips as well, and you guys can put them in your newsletters, and you guys can use them and share those as well to promote your expertise, because we want you guys to shine. And that's what we love about this meeting, is that we're not just coming and presenting information to you like, oh, we're the experts of everything, just sit and take notes. We feel like you guys have so much to offer, and we feel like we are better by learning from everybody that is able to share their expertise. We feel like that really helps us to stay up to speed on all these different areas of marketing. So March 20th, join us again. We'll do this on the third Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. on LinkedIn Live. And yeah, sign up for the podcast and subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we would greatly appreciate it. And invite your friends, everybody.
And Stephanie, I put those links in the chat. So perfect. If you want to capture those, the last one is the newsletter. We don't send out a lot of them. We send out maybe, you know, a couple times a month, just with what's coming up at the next meeting and maybe some tips from the previous meeting, some video tips. And then that's it.
That's right. Wonderful. Well, thank you everybody for coming today, and we look forward to seeing you guys next month.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the SoGrow Marketing Council podcast. Want to be part of our next meeting? Visit SoGrowPR.com. That's SoGrowPR.com. And click on the Marketing Council tab to sign up for our next event. Until next time, keep growing.